Hi, and welcome to Profiles. I'm Peter Noble-Cachera, and today we'll be talking with screenwriter and producer Angelo Pizzo, who wrote and produced the 1986 film Hoosiers, which is often called one of the greatest sports films ever made. He also wrote the screenplay for Rudy and The Game of Their Lives. Angelo, it's a pleasure to have you here today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hoosiers and Rudy both concern small-town Indiana boys who go on to become heroes. You're an Indiana native. Did you grow up in a small town?
Well, it depends on how you define Bloomington.
It was Bloomington.
In some ways, it's a small town. In other ways, it's not. It has, in terms of population, when I grew up, it was 22 to 25 without the students. With the students, it was probably 40 to 50. Now it's doubled in size, but because it was a transient mobile kind of in-and-out population student-wise, it still had a small-town feel. There's no question about it.
Were you a sports guy? You've made three movies which could be called sports movies. Did you play basketball or football?
I loved sports growing up. I was probably baseball was my biggest sport, in part because that's what was the only organized sport for youth at that time. Mm-hmm. And baseball was America's game in the 50s and 60s.
Sure.
It changed after that, of course. But when I got to high school, my lack of speed, size, and agility put me into more of a fan than a participant.
Right.
Which is, I guess if I had played maybe I'd never written the three movies I did.
Did you have a movie love when you were young, or did that come later?
Oh, I had a great passion for films from the time I can remember. In part, it was introduced to me early by my mother, who would take me to films ordinarily an 8 to 10-year-old wouldn't see, like Ingmar Bergman, Louis Buñuel.
Really?
Yeah. Yes, I saw a lot of the foreign films that were making big splashes at the time. But I also loved the great Hollywood films. I was a big fan of Westerns. I remember going to the Indiana Theater, the Princess Theater, and watching movies over and over again. I would go in and I'd buy a ticket for 1 o'clock and watch three straight showings. My father would always know where to get me if I didn't show up for dinner.
Third row.
One time I'd actually been gone for a long time, and he checked all the theaters. But what he didn't realize was that I was in the front row and I wasn't tall enough for my head to be seen. So
it's a good way to avoid the radar. And again, this is, you know, one of the nice things about Bloomington being a small town that also, you know, has the university is, you know, if you had grown up in Milan, Indiana, you would not be seeing any Bergman movies. So
that's true. Yeah. It's true. And also, I must add, you know, part of my love of sports happened because of Indiana University. Our home. Our first two homes were within 3 or 4 blocks of the campus, so I could ride my bike over, watch Indiana football practice and basketball practice. I have very fond memories of being sort of the team mascot when I was in probably, eight to 10 years old. I used to rebound free throws for Walt Bellamy and Herbie Lee and some of the great old, you know, Indiana legends.
Well, I can see, you know, from your background, maybe what some of why you were attracted to the story of Rudy Rudiger, which we'll get to a little bit later. You know, somebody who was not the biggest guy in the world, who didn't have all the athletic ability in the world, but he just loved this stuff. But specifically about the movie side of it, a lot of people who end up working in movies say that they had sort of a seminal moment when they're watching a movie, maybe, or they're in a theater, and they say suddenly it dawns on them, you know, I could do that, or I want to do that. Did you have any specific time like that, kind of an epiphany?
No.
No.
In fact, I never thought I could do that. One of the problems, or maybe it's not a problem for a certain kind of personality, at least one of the obstacles to creating that dream for yourself is having someone that you know that does it.
Sure.
Having a model.
Sure.
And for example, my young son wants to play quarterback on an NFL team.
Okay.
Now, that's realistic for him because the starting quarterback for the Chicago Bears grew up 2 blocks from him. He's met him. We went to Peyton Manning's birthday party. He met him. He met Eli Manning. So these are people that he has actually had personal contact with.
Sure.
I had never heard of anybody who had anything to do with films growing up here. And the idea of actually making them and being part of that business, it just seemed like it would be easier to be an astronaut.
Well, they do, don't they? I mean, when you live in the Midwest and you grow up here, it's like the movies have descended from Mars. They
Correct.
Arrive at the theater fully formed. You have no idea what a best boy is or a grip and or a gaffer, and you probably don't even stay for the credits. So there's you don't know anybody who's working in this stuff. I mean, they're a coastal industry, so.
Very much so. It's quite a bit different now because there is a much more of a communication between the film kind of – there are little pockets of filmmaking mm-hmm. communities all over the place that – and not very many films are shot on location in Los Angeles. They were
all shot
there, you know, at one time, all on studios. So there's not the big – moat around the castle and the walls, and it doesn't seem as insular anymore. The films that are nominated for Academy Awards mm-hmm. are usually made outside of Hollywood. You know, they're made in this place or that place or Canada or New York or Cleveland. And the ability to make films now is quite a bit more accessible mm-hmm. than it was for us. I mean, when growing up, I remember in college, if you wanted to make a movie, you'd have to buy a 16-millimeter camera. You'd have to buy 60-millimeter film and all of the things that go along with that. That was probably an expensive and difficult proposition.
Now you can literally go to Circuit City or certainly online, probably not Circuit City, but buy a 24p camera for several thousand dollars, you know, a Macintosh and Final Cut, and you're it's democratized. You know, you're good to go.
You can actually make a film like that, and if it's a good film, get it seen at Sundance.
Yeah, and I mean something like Open Water, which was, you know, shot on weekends, you know, for 2 years on just a camera like that and on a desktop Mac, and it ends up, you know, not only getting worldwide distribution but making umpteen million dollars, 30 plus. I mean, really, anybody can do it. I shouldn't say anybody can do it. It's available for those with the drive to do it.
And the imagination.
And the imagination.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, it also increases the competition.
Sure, which
when,
is a good
when,
thing.
When, for the yes movies. And no, but it's also – look, it's always been a competitive business.
Mm-hmm.
When I remember when I was writing the film, the screenplay for Hoosiers, my first spec script, someone told me that over 50,000 screenplays are registered at the Writers Guild in Los Angeles alone.
Can you tell us what a spec script is?
A spec script is you're just writing a script on your own, hoping
right.
someone buys it, as opposed to someone paying you to write a script. But now I think it's probably well over 150,000. In addition to that, a film festival, the biggest film festival even back then was the U.S. Film Festival or Sundance. They probably had maybe a couple hundred submissions. They had, I think, over 5,000. It's narrower and narrower. The competition increases with the accessibility.
And of course, something like that may be tougher for the filmmaker to hear get your voice heard over the tumult, but it can't help but be good for the movies. And as you mentioned, all five of the Best Picture candidates this year were independent films of some stripe or another. They weren't big studio films. Well, let me ask you about your early career in the movies, because I know you started out as a development executive.
Mm-hmm.
So you were a behind-the-scenes insider. Can you tell me exactly what your job was or what you were responsible for?
Well, let me go back before that,
sure.
because I think that in order to follow up on your question about the seminal moment of when I
sure.
knew I could make films or not, because it seemed like an alien environment, how did I end up in Los Angeles? I'm asking the question to myself.
Yeah, I should have asked the question.
Okay. How that happened is that I was, because I didn't think of a career in the film business, I got an undergraduate degree in political science.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to go to law school or graduate school in the state and try to work in the State Department in Washington. The Vietnam War changed a lot for
mm-hmm,
me. I became
mm-hmm.
very involved in the anti-war movement, became conscientious objector, and became very disenchanted with the system, the governmental system, which put us in such dire straits back then. I dropped out. I basically dropped out of society. I went and sort of escaped to Hawaii, to Aspen, searching for a sense of self, a goal, a direction. And I was talking to my father one time, and he really encouraged me to really identify what I love and follow the bliss, as mm-hmm. Joseph Campbell, find the way. And the thing that kept on coming back more and more was film. I just – it was a passion of mine. I bought film books. I went to foreign film festivals. I knew – I had a tremendous wealth of information about movies. He said, and I think influenced by growing up in a town like Bloomington, if you love something, get a degree in it and teach it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that there were film studies programs developing. There was one here. It was part of the comparative literature department. And I thought it would be interesting to take an academic approach to mm-hmm. it and write pieces and maybe be a critic. So there were three schools that offered doctorates at the time, mm-hmm. USC, UCLA, and NYU.
Yeah.
I particularly liked USC's because I felt I had much more of an opportunity to create my own program. They had just started it, and they sort of welcomed me in a way. The umbrella title was History, Theory, and Criticism, and they offered me, help us make the program work. As a beginning student.
I know that school, too, likes people who have some life experience, the graduate school there.
Mm-hmm.
So they were probably liked that about you, too.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know how I ultimately got,
got
admitted.
There, right?
You know, I was admitted to NYU, too. I was turned down by UCLA, but it didn't matter. I felt that it was more interesting to me to live in Los Angeles where films are made than New York. And so I went out there and I spent 3 years working on a doctorate, actually wrote my master's thesis, completed most of my hours for my doctorate. But in the interim, I had gotten a job. I'd made some spare money doing being a test contestant on a game show. And the guy producer liked me and offered me a job writing questions for a game show that he was developing. It happened to be called MTMAM. Grant Tinker was the president. Grant Tinker at the time had a number of shows on the air, including Mary Tyler Moore. And he offered me an internship, which he would give to a USC student and get 3 hours credit on the last season of the Mary Tyler Moore show.
There's your toehold in the industry, you know.
Well, it was actually at that moment getting to know Jim Brooks and Alan Burns, the creative team behind that, who are just great guys. You know, there are guys I felt like, you know, I could hang out with them. They didn't seem that intimidating and that special, although they are quite special. They're extraordinary talents. I thought, well, maybe I could, you know, this business. But I had put so much time into the writing and the research that I didn't really give it that much legitimate thought because I knew if I asked, thousands of people were asking them from jobs all the time. Grant Tinker told me that there was a producer, a friend of his, on the Warner Brothers lot that needed research done on a show that just got a pickup for 13 episodes. It was about a large family from the Midwest, and Grant said, I thought about you. And so I went to interview with this the producer who said, give me everything, you know, personal experience, everything about Flint, Michigan, a family in Flint, Michigan. I came back 2 weeks later with all the stuff, and we had a great talk, and No mention of jobs. About 2 or 3 weeks later, I got a call from him saying, my assistant just quit.
Yep.
Would you like to be, you know, I will teach you more in this next 6 months about making movies than you'll learn in 6 years at any
sure
film
it was
school.
True. Yep.
And it was absolutely true. I went to my counselor and said, could I take 6 months off to take this job? And he said, well, you know, this has happened to me before, and I can guarantee you I'll never see you again. I said, no, you will, because I put three years of work into this doctorate, and I'm going to do it. Well, I put everything into that box, and I've never opened that box since.
You know, it seems to be that's how Los Angeles works, is that, you know, even if you're not actively networking all the time, you're in the industry. I mean, you're just living there, going to Starbucks, you know, going to Pavilions to, you know, to get some groceries. I mean, you're always bumping into people whose lives are movies. And so jobs can come in funny ways like that.
It's true.
As a development executive, I'm sure that you were, you know, you were seeing tons of scripts come across your desk or through your office. They were just never going to get made. There's actually this term development hell that I'm sure you're familiar with, which is, you know, scripts get optioned and they circle the drain forever and they never get made. Did you enjoy that job? Am I characterizing it right?
I did a number of things as a development executive. Mm-hmm. The first portion of that job was in movies of the week and miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really long-form television. And I worked for two fairly successful producers who basically trained me to do what they did. And they would give me their assignments all the time when they got overloaded. And that was to listen to pitches for writers to come in. And if we liked them, put together a program or a pitch that would work for what we thought the needs were of the networks, go in and pitch that story. And once we got a sale, a script development deal, I would supervise the writing of the script. We would talk the story points out with the writer, and then we go back in the network and go back and forth with that. Once we got a go-ahead to make a film, then I would supervise production in the kind of way that I would work with the director and the producer to a certain extent. I mean, more often than not, I was locked into my office. I didn't go on the set all that much. Mm-hmm. But I learned producing. I ended up actually producing a number of films before I wrote anything.
Let's take a break, okay, and we'll hear some of Jerry Goldsmith's score for Hoosiers, a movie that Angelo Pizzo wrote and produced. And when we come back, we'll talk about the genesis of that movie. Welcome back to Profiles. We're talking today with Angelo Pizzo, the writer and producer of Hoosiers and also the writer of Rudy and The Game of Their Lives. So we've been talking a little bit about how you got into the movie business. I'd like to jump now to the point where Hoosiers started to be a project that you were thinking about. You had met your director and producing partner, David Ansbaugh. Am I saying his name correctly, mm-hmm, Ansbaugh? When you were in college at IU, and I know that you had a shared movie love and you struck up a friendship. And I think I'm correct in understanding that both you and David, growing up, being into sports, had heard the story of Milan High School and their David and Goliath state championship, this tiny little school of 60-odd students who, mm-hmm, went on to win state. Can you tell me a little bit about the genesis of that and how you went from being a development executive to somebody who wanted to write a screenplay and wanted to get this movie made?
Well, there were a number of factors involved with your question. One is that it wasn't that David and I heard about the story. Everybody heard about the story, mm-hmm, growing up. I mean, every year before the tournament, every newspaper in Indiana would bring the story out. I think in part to give hope, to give a kind of a carrot at the end of the stick to some of the smaller teams that they too can or could manage to pull this off. It was a very inspirational story for all high school teams back then. When we were in college, we talked about what we thought would make a great movie. We always talked about what we thought, you know, ideas for movies. When I was working with writers, and I moved over into the feature film area, I worked with some terrific writers, including a screenplay for one of the movies I loved so much growing up, West Side Story, Arthur Lawrence.
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
And the thing that amazed me about him, and I think he's really a great writer, so don't take this wrong, but we were in multiple meetings, and I thought we were had the understanding of what particular scenes needed to happen in what kind of way. And in my mind, I had written those scenes and I'd seen them. And when he came back with the material, it was just flat and, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, without life. And I really felt it was because he didn't care. I think he just wanted to pick up the paycheck and run out. But it made me at that time, you were talking about a seminal moment, mm-hmm, made me want to write those particular scenes, mm-hmm, that we were developing
and put some passion into
it. It was a remake of Summertime, a movie he had written before. I think he didn't want to write another version of the same movie. That, mm-hmm, that was part of the problem. While at Time Life Films, I was vice president of feature film production, and I had completed my first year. I just signed a contract to do another year. I was in a situation where I wasn't selling to networks. We were buying projects. I was putting projects into development for writers coming in to pitching to me. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to do the Hoosier story. I wanted to do the Milan story. And it was important to me to find a writer from Indiana or someone who's very familiar with Indiana, not the Midwest generically, but Indiana.
Indiana, keep it rooted.
And I'll tell you why. Because I really felt that the state of Indiana, the specificity of the location, mm-hmm. was as important a character as the Norman Dale character, the coach. The reason I ended up writing the script was because of a movie called Breaking Away.
Oh, yeah.
And breaking – and not in a positive way, but in a negative way. I have tremendous respect for this movie, Breaking Away. Steve Tessich was a friend of mine. It was a great script. He won the Academy Award. He deserved it. On and on and on. But
you felt that wasn't Bloomington?
That was not Bloomington.
Okay.
I didn't recognize a single character
okay.
in that yep. movie that had anything to do, yeah. not only with Bloomington, but Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
They had they didn't rock right. They didn't talk right. It was like somebody had flown in from outer space. Actually, they had. The reason that it was cast the way it was and it felt the way it was, so it's not so much Steve, but Peter Yates,
sure. yeah.
who director. Was English. Peter Yates had never heard of the state of Indiana
right.
before he took this job on. He'd never been to the Midwest. And the truth about Breaking Away is it didn't need to be rooted in place. It was a generic college town. I mean, it easily could have been Eugene, Oregon, mm-hmm. or even Corvallis, for that matter. It still would have worked. I mean, it's a movie that works, and very few movies do work. And I don't want to take anything away from it.
Sure.
But if you're going to call a movie Hoosier, it's going to be about the relationship of basketball and the people in Indiana. I wanted people to have the details absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that if I was going to be a producer of it, I was going to try to find a writer. I could never find a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also – my plan was to hire an Indiana director if, mm-hmm. or somebody who knew Indiana. And I had David in mind, obviously. He had never directed a feature before, but he had just won an Emmy Award for A Hill Street Blues. What happened at Time Life Films was they had a lawsuit was brought against Time Inc.
Mm-hmm.
because of an antitrust ruling having to do with HBO controlling all the movies that were coming out. So the other studios put together a consortium. And there was this back and forth and this – whole question about multi-tiering and ultimately the judge said, okay, well, we're all in your favor, but you can't have your own production unit. Now, of course, that's a joke.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to disband the whole production unit. And I had just signed my contract out and they offered to pay me out in full, which they did. I was financially independent for the first time in my life. And I didn't really want to hop back into another job. I was offered a job at HBO. And it really broke my heart losing that job, and I'll tell you why. Because I had a lot of projects in development that were my babies, and they all had to go over to Fox. You know, that was part of the deal. And relationships with writers kind of went by the wayside. One of the scripts that I put in development, which was a favorite of mine, was written by a guy named Ron Shelton, who is a terrific, the great sports,
Bull Durham.
Exactly, yes.
And Tin Cup and on and on.
And a movie that was shot here by William Friedkin, you know, on location.
Blue Chips.
Blue Chip was one of the first projects that I bought and put in development. Just coincidentally, Indiana had just gotten into the Final Four, and this is 1981. And was in Philadelphia. I went to negotiate or kind of settle out my contract in New York and went down to Philadelphia to watch Indiana win the national championship. Then rather than flying back to L.A., I flew back to Bloomington to visit my family and, again, talk to my parents and said I was kind of like maybe taking a break, didn't know what I wanted to do right away. It was like getting a divorce. You don't want to date, right? You know, you know, a week afterwards. And I talked about my notion of writing this screenplay about Hoosiers. And I said, I don't know if it's commercial or not, but it would give me a sense of whether I could write a screenplay. And if it didn't work out, it would help me understand the process better in working with screenwriters in the future.
Let me ask you, you'd worked with writers, you had a long time love of movies, you'd read tons of books. Had you ever read any books about screenwriting?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you had?
Mm-hmm. In retrospect, and it's something I would actually, people ask me all the time what book I would recommend or whether I recommend taking screenwriting courses and so on and so forth.
What do you recommend?
I recommend if you're a really good friend and I like you, I will teach you everything you need to know in 2 hours and forget about everything else.
Sure.
I literally could give, I believe, a lecture that would cover all you would need to know. And everything else is basically people trying to make money.
Mm-hmm, sure. For people who, you know, aren't your best friend, is there a book that's worth that's worth anything? Do you like the – I mean, you mentioned Campbell earlier. There's the book The Writer's Journey, which sort of talks about Campbell's breaking down the mythic quest and how that can be used for screenwriting. I mean, is that any good?
I really think that when you take an approach like that, which is becoming over-analytical to what you're trying to do, then the right side of your brain get in the way of your left side of your brain, or the other way around, I'm sorry, vice versa. The rational, linear, objective part is your enemy.
Gets in the way
it's
of your artistic
enemy
sense.
Of writing.
Well,
yeah.
You know, so that actually is a question I was going to ask you, which is, did you ever set out to write self-consciously mythic stories? Because I haven't seen The Game of Their Lives, but both Rudy and Hoosiers are their mythic stories. I mean, they have sort of mythic iconography. They're underdog stories and about a hero's journey. But you apparently didn't ever, you know, intentionally follow that structure.
No, I learned very early on what I liked and didn't like. I probably read maybe 1,000 screenplays. Now, having said that, I had analyzed the genre structure of films for 3 years. My thesis was the genre theory of film criticism, which is the antithesis of the auteur theory. Mm-hmm. It was really breaking down films based on they're playing into the conventions or away from the conventions of the existing genres.
And the auteur theory is basically the idea that the director is the author of the film.
Correct.
Right.
And I used the films of Arthur Penn as the kind of way in. So I was all about my left brain or my right brain. I can't figure out.
I don't know the difference.
It's one of those, whatever the side of your brain is.
Neither side
is the rational, linear, objective side. In answer to your question,
sure.
No. I absolutely did not. I respond to stories and characters and what I can feel. It's a gut feeling. And when I read all those screenplays, I probably remember – less than 10 that I thought I'd want to see his films.
And that makes sense.
I believe the rest of them, for the most part, more than anything, there were some great ideas. Mm-hmm. There were some great characters,
some great
writing, dialogue.
Sure.
The one thing that was missing.
Is the structure.
You can call it structure, but it's not quite – that's not quite it.
Story.
Narrative.
Narrative. Okay.
It's the ability that people have or don't have. And this is why I find it difficult to talk about teaching screenwriting. You have either an innate ability to tell a story or you don't.
Oh, you think so, huh?
I really do. I think that you can teach it in this regard. You can put together a perfectly constructed, well-thought-out screenplay that hits all the right points, but if it has no subtext, if it has no life, if it's written from the outside in rather than the inside out, then basically you're going to not feel it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get it. There are some times where that might work really well, whether it be a mystery or a thriller where the plotting has to be really precise, or, you know, perhaps comedies where you don't maybe care if it's so broad that you don't care about who the characters are. But if you're talking about drama, I really think that the best stories are the ones that you feel innately. You feel the character's journey. And you feel the inherent narrative structure.
I want to actually interject something about Hoosiers and Rudy, which I've seen, and The Game of Their Lives I haven't yet seen. But with those two movies, Hoosiers and Rudy, you feel them. You feel them. And they pretty much are – the story and characters just come through so strong. They're all heart, which is a bit of a cliche, but I think it's very true in this case. A statistic that I wanted to toss out is RottenTomatoes.com is a website which surveys critical writing and reactions to movies. And then they have this sort of reductive numerical tomato meter, I think it's called, which is a thermometer of how many critics were positive and how many were negative. Hoosiers got a 96% score on Rotten Tomatoes, which means that of the critics surveyed, 96% thought it was a great movie. And that is extraordinarily rare. I've monitored that site for years.
Well, it's interesting about this movie, Hoosiers, because that particular percentage was not the percentage that we experienced when the movie came out.
Oh, is that right?
No. There are actually a number of critics that gave us a big thumbs down that have been a bit revisionist mm-hmm. about their feeling about the film. It has grown in stature and critical respect when it was probably, I would say, 65 to 70% the tomato meter.
How about that?
Back then. Yeah.
And those who didn't like it, was it because of what
I'm
saying?
Look, there is always a fine line between sentiment and sentimentality.
Sure, sure.
And the critics that bopped us were the ones who felt we went over the line and were too sentimental. Even though people liked it and people praised us and we got tremendously high test scores when we were screening the film before we released it, there was a great deal of doubt about its ability to sustain an audience outside mm-hmm. of Indiana.
People don't even know what a Hoosier is.
They thought it was, you know, it's a cliched story and it's just, you know, they couldn't sell it. The log line, a small town team wins a state championship, mm-hmm. a coach comes to find himself,
right.
all those kind of things. It sounds tired just to tell you about it. I think that there are a couple of things that happened. It caught the distributors, Orion Pictures, by surprise. They weren't planning a national mm-hmm. release. In fact, they made us open it in Indiana to prove that we could sustain the film longer than 6 weeks in order to get a national release. They weren't, and they didn't believe in the film to the point
even
where—
Even though you got great test scores in, was it Irvine?
But they didn't believe they could sell it. They didn't believe they could get people in the movies. It's one thing to get test scores. There wasn't anybody any star that people went to see movies for.
Gene Hackman wasn't an
opener?
No,
he wasn't. In fact, he had made 7 failed films in a row before Hoosiers.
And not to derail this, but, mm-hmm. but it's funny that Jack Nicholson was attached originally to play the part of Coach Dale, and his involvement kind of got it jump-started, as I understand. And then when his schedule precluded being in it, Gene Hackman came in. And mm-hmm. Now, of course, we look at it and we can't imagine anyone else in that role.
That's true. Yeah, we, you know, I don't know if you read this story because it's part of the lore now, but we ran into Jack, and Jack had committed to do it. And as you said, he was it was a lawsuit that he had with MGM. He couldn't work for a certain amount of time, and then he was committed to the Two Jakes, which actually got postponed, but the following year, and. We ran into him. We got 2 Academy Award nominations
for Dennis Hopper
and the score.
And the score.
And we were going to a party afterwards, and David ran into him. I mean, we saw him, and David went up to he came over to us. He said, "You guys did a great job. You know, terrific. Act was great. Hopper was great." And David said, "You know, we've always wondered what that movie would have been like if you had been the coach." And Jack put his arm around David, and you know, one of his eyebrows went up, and he said, "Megabucks, kid,
right,
megabucks."
Right.
So, who knows?
You know,
I don't
knows?
Think
we'll
you know. The
know.
Thing it is, I felt, in retrospect, it's easy to say, but if Jack were in the film, it would probably be considered, because of his stature then and even now, a Jack Nicholson movie.
Oh yeah,
and
oh,
not
yeah.
an ensemble piece. This is so much an ensemble piece, and Gene blends in so well with the world. I mean, he's from a small town in Illinois,
Decatur,
Danville.
Danville, you're yeah. right. Yeah.
But getting back to the critical aspect of Hoosiers respect, it's grown in stature. When they did rankings for best films, best sports films, mm-hmm. we barely cracked the top 10 in the first 5 years.
Whereas you know? Now ESPN rates it as the number one sports film of all time, as did Time Magazine, number one.
Yeah, and USA Today did a viewers poll and did the same thing.
How about
but,
that?
But,
yeah.
but that wasn't the case for many years. I think, honestly, one of the advantages we have with this film is that it was a period piece to begin with, mm-hmm. so it didn't age. it really never
point.
Aged. It
yeah.
never, and a lot of the sports films that we loved so much at the time, and not taking anything away from Ron Shelton and Bull Durham, but that seems like a very dated film now. Hmm. I mean, part of it was soundtrack, part of it is language, but it is of a piece. Mm-hmm. We tried to capture the 50s in the Midwest and before. The consciousness of America was homogenized by mm-hmm, television. Mm-hmm. And that was really the last true era of regionalism. And
yeah,
I did a lot of research. We all did a lot of research to try to get that right.
And yeah, getting it right, I think I've heard both you and David Ansbaugh say was, you know, a big motivating factor. So let's get this right. Otherwise, when we go home, we're not going to be able to show our faces around, you know.
It's true. Yeah. I think that we were more concerned about having people from Indiana be proud of it than anything else. You know, we knew that we were toying with their state legend and their sport and the real fabric of their lives, basically. The way in which community and family and sport and religion and politics all connect.
The movie wouldn't have done so well, and it wouldn't have attained the status that it now has if it weren't connecting in some universal way, which is much far beyond being, quote-unquote, a sports movie. Would you say it's safe to say that the themes that connect with people are those of second chances and courage?
It's very interesting that you ask me. I don't really like to analyze my movies.
Okay.
I don't like
you
to
want
do
to say this is what it's about.
My first draft was so long. I wrote everybody's stories. I had a relation. I had Buddy, one of the team members, and Loetta, one of the cheerleaders, had a whole kind of relation. I just wanted to get it all out there. And then when I was cutting it down, I had to try to figure out a particular thematic approach. And it was, yes, it was about second chances. And I sort of wrote that unconsciously. I didn't write it going in that way, but I saw that the kind of characters and relationships that didn't quite fit were those that didn't dovetail in with each other in that thematic way. What the sort of corollary to the thematic approach of second chances is, it's not enough to have a second chance. It's important that someone other than yourself provide you with it.
Hmm.
In other words, none of those people just on their own pick themselves up by their bootstraps. It was the support of a coach or a friend or a father or a preacher or someone or a community that allowed that person to have another opportunity to succeed where they had failed previously.
Let's take this opportunity to take another break. And when we come back, let's talk about Rudy a little bit. And so for now, let's hear some of the score from Rudy, the great Jerry Goldsmith score from that film. Hello and welcome back to Profiles. Our guest today is Angelo Pizzo, who wrote and produced the movie Hoosiers and also wrote the movies Rudy and The Game of Their Lives. Like Hoosiers, Rudy is based on a true story. Daniel Rudy Rudiger was one of 14 kids in a working-class family. He'd always been told that he's not smart enough to go to college, and in fact, he's dyslexic but doesn't know it. He's also a little guy, 5'6" and 170 pounds, and he doesn't have a lot of raw athletic skill, but he is determined that he's going to get into Notre Dame and play football for the Fighting Irish, which were the best football team in the country. He doesn't expect to start. His dream is simply to dress and come out of the tunnel with the team onto the field. He's had this dream since he was a child. So here's a second time that as a screenwriter, you sought out a true story and, again, a sports story. So why search for material in the real world rather than just making it up?
Well, first of all, I didn't seek it out. It sought me. Rudy came knocking on our door trying to convince us to write his movie. And I basically said no for a period of 2 years. And he was relentless.
I don't
just
think
like
that word
character.
Has ever stopped.
No. He's fundamentally incapable of hearing that word. I was not interested in following up Indiana sports movie with another Indiana sports movie. I really was working on some other things at the time. The second thing was, having grown up in Bloomington, Indiana, I hated Notre Dame football. I just couldn't figure out a way to get into that find that love for that character had for the university and the sport. But how the movie got sold and how I got involved with it is sort of serendipitous. The David Anspaugh, mm-hmm. the director, who always loved the story, was talking to a producer about another sports story, and he brought this up, and this producer said, the president of Columbia Pictures went to Michigan State, and he said, my biggest regret is never going to Notre Dame. I love that school, and I really wish I could have gone there.
And there it was.
And I thought, and I said, oh, we could sell it to this guy. And all of a sudden, he said, we can get this as a development deal at Columbia Pictures. And so at the time, I just had a bad experience with a script with a big-time producer, who I won't mention, just beat up on me on a regular basis. And I thought, maybe there's an opportunity where we have the freedom to do what we did with Hoosiers again. And that I could figure out a way to create a love for Notre Dame football. So that's how that started. What appealed to me about it, of course, it is a great story. I felt that was a story that I could relate to, mm-hmm. only because not because I was a terrible athlete and wanted to be a great athlete. I kind of gave up those dreams early. But I think it's a metaphor for the film business.
Sure.
You know, basically.
Dreamers.
Well, yeah. David probably can tell this story more appropriately than myself, because I wasn't imagining a career in the film business. David wanted a career in the film business. Mm-hmm. There were like four or five courses at Indiana. And I remember we took one course. It was a course about – it wasn't about directing. It was analyzing the director, because mm-hmm. the director in the 70s was a big thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And the teacher there, who was an academic, said – for all of you, everybody wants to be a director now. Mm-hmm. And I'll bring up the term astronaut again. Because that's where I got it. Mm-hmm. He said, you would have an easier time getting an astronaut's program than you would directing a feature film for a studio.
I'm sure that's right.
In other words, don't even dream it.
Yeah.
Forget about it. You have no chance. That reminded me of what people would tell Rudy. And mm-hmm. and anybody who had a dream, kind of that little pilot light of hope.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah,
that
flickering little flame.
That flickering little flame that can be put out so
Absolutely.
Easily by one comment, like
Absolutely.
A guy like that. Or
you
if you get the right person, it can flame into something special.
And you see those moments in the film that are just punishing when people are literally trying to put out his flame. I mean, it's like they have something to prove. And I thought about screenwriters, and I thought about, you know, you and trying to get Hoosiers made, when there's this shot in Rudy where there's this enormous crane shot. Rudy's trying to buy a ticket to get into the game. He's only got 10 bucks. He needs 90. And the crane shot goes up and up and up. And on the left side of the frame, you see all the fans, thousands of fans enjoying the game. And on the right is this diminishing little figure of Rudy on the other side of a wall. And you say it's a metaphor for the film industry. I mean, isn't that it, that it's just no, 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 and you're up against a wall all the time trying to make Hoosiers?
To this day, it's still up against the wall.
Sure.
Yes, it's every film you ever make, and that is absolutely true. Obviously, having never made a film, it's much more difficult. It seems more impossible, whereas it now seems possible. It's hard, mm-hmm. but it seems possible. That's a big difference. The thing that was I wanted to emphasize with especially his father and others, they didn't think about what they were doing to quash his dream or hurt his feelings. They didn't want him to be hurt. They did it in a caring and loving way. Mm. And I saw this, and I was doing actually research on another project, and I was looking at the difference between first and second generation Italians and how the first generation Italians had that same feeling and would tell their kids that they wanted them to be successful, but not so successful that they didn't try to reach too high and be disappointed.
Sure.
But I wanted to make it – you know it happens all – I mean, it happens in
it happens
people's
to
lives.
All of us.
Yeah. People are – you have that conversation with oneself. You know, you don't even – you don't have other people tell you. When people come to me and say, should I make could I make a living in the film business? Should I go out there? And I said, it is high stakes. It's high competition. The odds are against you. If you're willing – to live that life, you should go for it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want something more secure, if you want to make sure that your family is provided for, if you want to have a job that pays a weekly salary, you know it keeps on coming, it's not the place for you.
Yeah, yeah.
That's sort of the realistic way of approaching it.
Well, that's a nice way to, you know, tell somebody about the reality without closing down the possibility. There's I don't remember which director said this, but he always tells people that when they ask him if they can become a director, he says, no, absolutely not. And if you ignore me, you're halfway there.
Well, it's true. And that's certainly that's Rudy's a perfect example of
sure.
that. You know, he just wouldn't hear no. And quite frankly, one of my challenges in writing this movie was to create a character that was likable. Mm-hmm. Because Rudy was so much of a bulldog. He was so persistent that he was perceived by many as obnoxious and pushy.
Whereas in the movie, you're aided by the performance of Sean Astin, who has this openness.
Sweetness.
And sweetness, mm-hmm. which pulled you through, absolutely.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It was a critical piece of casting. And I think that what we also did is create something that wasn't quite accurate in terms of Rudy's life, at least in the second 2 years of his life, is a real loneliness. That this journey, a journey to achieve your dreams, oftentimes is a lonely venture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that our heart goes out to someone like that who has the courage to travel that path and do so knowing that they sacrifice a lot. Loss of connection to family, to friends, and to others who, you know, would ordinarily be from his mm-hmm. past and part of the fabric of his life.
Yeah, his girlfriend, when mm-hmm. he tells her that he's going to South Bend, there's one of the most painful moments in the film. She says, "You're going to go alone." And he says, "I know. You know, I'm mm-hmm. sorry."
Mm-hmm.
We've got just a few minutes left, and there is a third film of yours that was mm-hmm. produced called The Game of Their Lives, and I think it's coming out on DVD soon. And we don't have a lot of time, but could mm-hmm. you talk a little bit about that movie and about your experience on that movie?
Well, that movie was I don't know. It's hard to sum it up because it was – I worked on this film longer than I worked on any of the other films. I produced it – I was the only last man standing.
Mm-hmm.
We went through so many difficult problems on this film. There were so many obstacles.
With David Ansbaugh again.
With David, yes. But we had a whole change of regime in the company that financed the film. We had new people coming in. David walked off the film. I was the only person left for 6 months on the bill. I did my own cut. I was the only person going to the screenings.
Did he walk off during principal photography?
Oh, no. This was in post-production.
Okay.
Yeah, this was not during principal. We faced obstacles we never dreamed existed and came anywhere close to with Rudy or Hoosiers. We did not have the same kind of support system that we had on those other films. We made our mistakes in casting and crew. We are responsible for some of the things that went wrong. And I would say when people ask, how different is the movie than what you wrote on all three films? On Hoosiers and Rudy, I would say 85% to 90%, which is
85 to different?
No.
No, the same.
The same,
yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Which is extraordinarily high for any writer. And I hired the director.
Oh, did you? Were you a producer on Rudy, too?
Oh, yes.
Well? I've been
yes.
saying that wrong.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's very rare for
We have a rare relationship, David and I.
Yeah.
And David really doesn't mess around with the story or the dialogue. And directors do that.
They do. And he's also said about your writing that you don't get in the way of actors and directors interpreting, that you lay a bed for them to feel it out.
That's true.
Kind of look alike, I thought.
Well, people have said that.
Have they?
But, like an old married couple starting to look alike.
Right.
But getting back to the percentages, Game of Their Lives, I would say 45 to 50%.
Yikes. Yep.
Yeah. So about half of the movie that I imagined would happen didn't happen for all sorts of reasons. Again, I'm not going to lay off the blame to other people. David and I need to take some of it on ourselves. But we were not supported in the way which we were supported with other films, both in terms of creatively, financially, and other ways. And so it was a great disappointment. Having said that, I'm still proud of the film. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like all films are your children. Even the ones that just, you know, they struggle and they try to, you know, it takes them forever to walk and, you know, they're kind of the ugly duckling. You still love them. I still love this movie. I have a great fondness for it. And I see its flaws and I see its weaknesses. And we got killed by the critics. And I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm disappointed whenever a film of mine gets a bad review. But I don't grind my teeth or wring my hands. I can understand that point of view. That's not necessarily fair, but I think this was a unusual circumstance, and we learn more from this movie than the first two movies combined. More what not to do.
What's the big thing that you would do differently?
We would never have done the film. And David, to his credit, said, we've got to get out now. We've got to get out now. This is not going to work. This is not going to work. Part of the problem was we had a film that needed – that when it was originally budgeted was $45 million. They agreed to do it. We went into pre-production, and then they started chopping. They started chopping and chopping and chopping and chopping. So by the time they got down to $27 million, David wanted to pull out. I said, you know, on Hoosiers and Rudy, we did so well with the film while we were shooting it. They end up giving us more money. And I think we can do the same thing.
Yeah,
he said, it's a big mistake. Actually, they took – it kept on taking more money away from us.
Yeah.
So we were faced with – making we actually below the line because the above the line, which is the amount
fixed.
Of money you pay to actors and the crew, the key crew, that is the cinematographers and the director and writer and the story rights, was about $15 million.
And you can't change that.
And what we had to shoot this extraordinarily difficult movie to three locations: New York, St. Louis, and Brazil. In period, we had about $14 million to make,
wow.
Which is less than Rudy.
We have to wrap up now, and I don't mean to end on a down note. I don't think it is. I think it's a note of, you know, challenge, that it's a learning experience and you figure out how to not do that again. I know you've got projects in the works right now, which we can't talk about because they're still very fresh. But obviously, I wish you the best of luck with that, and I'm sure you will have success. And so that's the end of Profiles for today. Angelo Pizzo, thank you for joining us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Peter Noble Cachera. Thank you for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in April of 2006. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blackland McCord, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.